we want from a heroine now. We want them as to be the agent of their own lives. We want determination, activity.
That was author and historian Sarah Griswood on the qualities she believes modern audiences want to see in a medieval heroine.
It's this combination of familiarity and strangeness that makes the Victorian era so appealing. And it's also very appealing for a certain style of crime fiction.
And that was Nick Renison discussing his foray into historical fiction. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find us in all good newsagents and on subscription. Visit historyextra.com/subscribe-today for our latest subscription deals. And we also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, and Google Play. For details of all of those, head to historyextra.com/digital. The White Queen, the lavish BBC dramatisation of Philippa Gregory's Cousin's War series of books, is soon to draw to a close. One person who has been watching the series eagerly is historian Sarah Griswood, whose own work has covered similar grounds. We sent our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, to meet Sarah at her home in Kent, where they discussed whether accuracy in historical fiction really matters, and if the Plantagenets are now set to match the Tudors in the popularity stakes.
Okay, so Tudor history has dominated our TV screens for some years now, but The White Queen, which is on at the moment, explores the Plantagenet dynasty. Why do you think the Plantagenets have suddenly become so popular, and why hasn't this been the case before?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, as you say, the Tudors have absolutely dominated up till now. I think, and yet when you look at the Plantagenet, the material, it's absolutely amazing. You can quite see why Shakespeare was so fascinated. And you start to think, goodness, why haven't we heard much more before? I mean, look at the story being covered by the White Queen. You've got, you know, witchcraft, accusations of incest, fratricide, all this, and Pretty May Day romance too. But somehow, it's a hard question. I think partly the Plantagenets haven't been covered as well as they might, even in popular history. So maybe that's had a kind of knock-on effect. And I think that's down partly, at least, to the sources.
Okay.
The sources for this period are genuinely very difficult. They're very patchy, and oddly enough, they're far worse than they are for many earlier periods. And of course, they are worse than ever for women who fight on no battlefields and make pass no laws in Parliament. And I think that television and novels do tend to like women, like heroines, and we've had a bit of a job fishing them out of the Plantagenet era.
Okay. And The White Queen's attracted more than 5 million viewers during its first episode, but it has come under some criticism for some of its inaccuracies, and some of the ones that come to mind are zips on costumes and over-cleanliness of some of its characters. But should these types of inaccuracies matter? Do you think we should dismiss the series because of it?
Well, The White Queen has been criticised a lot for things like corduroy, zips on costumes, clothes pegs, visible cement, rubber soles on shoes, I think, was one. I'm not sure if those are the sort of inaccuracies that matter most. I feel there probably is a price to pay, you know, for popularising history. It's a big old ongoing debate, isn't it? And I'm not sure if those things aren't a price worth paying in the end. It was the same as with the Tudors, the television series, you know, and of course, I'm sure the White Queen is hoping to copy its popularity. And that was criticised for the fact that the costumes were 10 years or so out. I could live with that. Indeed and in truth, I could actually live with the fact that they amalgamated two sisters of Henry VIII into one, because I still think there is something, you know, some appreciation of the period you can usefully get all the same. The place where I had trouble there was when in a scene set, around 1530, they took some of the senior courtiers down and showed this brand new invention called the printing press. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, that came over, you know, here almost half a century earlier. And I'm not really sure if any appreciation you get of the early 16th century while thinking the printing press hadn't been invented yet is really useful. But I'm not sure that I've seen that kind of inaccuracies on the White Queen. Of course, the other interesting point is there is so much we don't know about this period as far as things like costumes go. Okay, we can be pretty sure they didn't have zip fasteners. but there are some very, you know, curious gaps in our knowledge. And while undoubtedly the whole thing does look, it looks like a shampoo ad, and do I really think, you know, all that they were that sparkling clean? No, of course I don't. But automatically going for dark and grungy is a bit of a trap as well, I think. If you know, sort of think of, Fra Angelico, or think of the colours on an illuminated manuscript. Yeah. After all, you know, their own world probably seemed more brightly coloured to them than it does to us, just looking back at, you know.
That's a good point. And do you think it's possible to have a completely accurate historical series and still make it appeal and make people want to watch it?
I doubt if it's possible ever to be 100% accurate for screen. Just partly, of course, because I'm one of the people who do believe there isn't really one single objective history, and so we don't actually really know what 100% accuracy was. But I think also our own prejudices and, you know, the feelings and opinions of our own age will inform us our views in so many ways we don't even realise that, in a sense, you're kind of scuppered before you start.
And of course, it's filmed in Belgium as well, isn't it? Do you think that's added to the series at all? Or?
Yes, that's interesting. The fact that they filmed in Bruges. Looking at it, actually, I do seem to get a slight flash of Belgium. Just the landscape and things, but I can quite see why they did it. I mean, Bruges is the most astonishing survival of these old buildings, far purer than anything I can think of here. The nearest equivalent here would be things like some of the Oxbridge colleges, but of course that wouldn't work, you know, for every scene, and never mind the practical problems.
And do you think it is right to make history appeal to a wider audience through historical dramas like The White Queen? Does a price have to be paid every time, do you think?
It's a juggling act, isn't it? I know Anthony Beaver, I think, invented the phrase histertainment, and some historians would certainly say that no, you know, the price is not worth paying. But the trouble is, what is the alternative? Mm. The alternative doesn't seem to be now, you know, more and better information of other sorts all too often. Yeah. The alternative may be no information at all. So, no, I guess on the whole, I tend to come down on the side of the popularisers within limits.
I mean, you've mentioned that there's problems with some of the sources. We don't have a lot of knowledge about the period. Do you think, what sort of sources do we have from the period to sort of help us with these types of things?
A lot of what we think of as contemporary sources for this particular late 15th century are in fact early 16th century ones, chronicles written some years after the event. And that's another whole question, you know, do we take those as being fact or not? The scene at the beginning of The White Queen is a good example in point. I think the series was criticised for this sort of what they called Mills and Boone romance, Elizabeth Woodville standing under the tree and exactly the oak tree waiting for Edward IV and stuff. But of course, the fact is that comes in Hall's Chronicle in 1552, I think. The idea of her saying that if she's too low to be his wife, she's too high to be his concubine, was Thomas More much earlier in the century. And the story of her defending her virtue with a dagger was reported by a writer who died in the 1480s. So the what sources we do have, you know, are often not altogether concerned with 100% objective fact. The mythologizing, the storytelling started very early.
I mean, it is a very exciting period. Why do you think it hasn't inspired more people to write about it? And
it is difficult, isn't it? Because, of course, the Wars of the Roses, heaven knows it had Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And now we've got this burst of, you know, popularity. I mean, the Philippa Gregory novels, the series, and fashion pages and the magazines have gone all sort of Guinevere Goes to Camelot. I see there's even a shade of lipstick called Queen Medieval.
There is.
Meant to be inspired by the colour you get if you rub berries on lips or something. I suppose the I think one of the problems actually is that this particular patch, The Wars of the Roses, doesn't necessarily show us to ourselves in a very good light.
Right.
It is usually presented in terms of the wars, the battlefields on which the great noble families, you know, fought for control of the country. That's one reason why the women have tended to get written out of the story a bit. But, I mean, this wasn't a kind of heroic war. This wasn't a patriotic war. There isn't really the equivalent of, you know, Henry V and Agincourt and all that. There's just a slight element, I think, of families who already have a lot squabbling to get even more. There's a kind of feeling almost that they were the greedy bankers of their day.
Yeah.
You know, and all we hear about are these powerful quarrelling nobles. And I think there has been a slight element of who cares who wins. And I think the way the Wars of the Roses were taught in schools hasn't really helped. Partly it was presented, certainly as I first saw it, you know, sort of Ladybird books when I was, you know, a young child and things, as a kind of neat two-party red rose versus white rose. And that was very kind of tidy and not terribly convincing. In fact, of course, if you look at it, and indeed even if you look at the series, you've got what's far more like politics as we know it today. You know, sudden changes of alliance, queasy coalitions, compromises. Yeah. And I think in a way we prefer that now. But I think we haven't quite known how to approach this for a long time.
Yeah. Do you think people are aware of some of the key characters? Obviously in the Tudor period we have very strong characters like Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, and people know those people, those characters.
No, actually, I'm not sure we are aware of that many of the characters. We should be, really, because looking at it, you think, well, part of it is, why wasn't Edward IV, you know, as vivid in people's minds as Henry VIII? Except not the six wives, of course. Maybe that's why. But no, I don't think. I think there was a time when people, yes, Warwick the Kingmaker was a sort of, you know, phrase. But I think that that's gone a bit now. And certainly when I began to write my book Blood Sisters, I was very taken aback by just how extraordinary the stories of these women were. But these were women of whom most people had never even heard. Mm. They may just about have heard of Elizabeth Woodville, but I mean, even take the three protagonists of this series, Elizabeth Woodville, Margaret Beaufort, Anne Neville.
Yeah.
You're not going to find many people who know much about Anne Neville, even though her story is as extraordinary as any in history.
Yeah. And just mentioning those three women, which do you think modern audience will be able to relate to the best? They're not kind of your typical heroines, are they?
No, I'm quite interested in the job that the writers, Philippa Gregory first, of course, had to make these women into sort of 21st century user-friendly heroines. Elizabeth Woodville, probably quite easy. After all, you know, a commoner who married a king for love.
Yeah.
Where have we heard that before recently? And Margaret Beaufort. Now, it's a bit difficult because a lot of the information we have about the real Margaret and the portraits and things are from her in old age. And it's all about her piety, her religion. And, you know, we can't quite relate to that very easily. But also it was clear she was formidably ambitious.
Yes.
a survivor and a fixer, and I think we can relate to that today. So she works as a heroine of a different sort. Anne Neville's the one with whom I think there is a problem. Yeah. I mean, she did have an amazing story, brought up as in a Yorkist family, then married off to the Lancastrian Prince of Wales to cement her father's unlikely alliance with them. That husband dead within months. Taken back into Yorkist care or custody, kept disguised as a kitchen maid. And that's even before she married the future Richard III. But, and it's a big, big but, with Anne Neville, the sources are awful, frankly. Right. There is an awful lot we don't know. Philippa Gregory, I know, has said in an interview that at a certain point she decided Anne Neville, would take control of her own destiny. Mm. Not her own dynasty, sorry. Her own destiny. Yeah. And that's what we want from a heroine now. We want them to be the agent of their own lives. Mm. We want determination, activity. Now, it's possible the real Anne Neville did the same thing.
Do you agree with
that?
Yeah.
We just don't know. All you can say from an honest non-fiction point of view is, sadly, the sources don't tell us.
Mm.
I hope it was true. I'd like to think it was true, but the evidence does not say.
So you think those women are the sorts of people that we want to see as heroines today?
I think for heroines today, we want them to be take charge types up to a point. I think there may have been a day when sort of victims played as heroines, but I'm not sure that's most successful now.
And Warwick in the series comes over as quite a dark character, doesn't he? Is that the kind of feeling that you get from him when you've been writing?
Yes, on the whole, yes. I think Warwick, I think you don't get to go down in history as the kingmaker without a good dollop of unscrupulousness and a fair old determination.
Yeah.
And after all, what do we know about him? We know that he did help Edward IV to the throne as the Yorkist king, but that then, when he wasn't getting what he felt he should from that dynasty, he married one of his daughters to Clarence, Edward's, who then tried to stage a coup, and married the other daughter to the Lancaster, made an unlikely alliance with Queen Margaret of Anjou, the Lancastrian, the deposed Lancastrian queen, who previously, he'd been at complete enmity, but anything for power.
Yeah. And what do you think the impact of the discovery of Richard III's remains has had on making the period kind of come up more in people's minds?
I think the discovery at Leicester of Richard's bones, I think it has changed things, actually. I think it just plain opened far more people's eyes to this period. But also, I think it brought a kind of a sort of actuality. I think part of the reason that we have always had more about the Tudors is we've got more buildings, we've got portraits, we have ways into them, basically.
Mm.
And it's almost that for anything before 1500, it's quite hard to find a way in. Most of the buildings are kind of stripped and despoiled. Most of the pictures aren't portraits as we know it. And I think finding Richard's skeleton, with the thing at the scoliosis and the reports of what they called the humiliation injuries inflicted probably after death, it gives a sort of human element.
Yeah.
And I think suddenly it all seems a lot closer to us than it did before.
It seemed like real people.
Yeah, exactly, like real people.
And finally, do you have any predictions as to what you think is going to be the next dynasty to come under the spotlight?
Well, I think we're moving back in time, really, because we've done the Tudors exhaustively and probably everything since, I mean, there's been stories always about the 18th century, the 19th century. Yeah. But if you move back and think of figures like, well, look at heroines, Catherine Swinford, there's a good romantic story for you. All that long, long relationship with John of Gaunt and finally marrying. And look, Eleanor of Aquitaine, well before. Now, you want a forceful heroine, you can't get much better than her. So I think history may be moving further backwards in time.
We may be about to talk to you about that in a year or so's time.
That was author and historian Sarah Gristwood. Sarah's book, Blood Sisters, The Women Behind the Wars of the Roses, is published by Harper Press. And if you're in the UK, you can catch the final episode of The White Queen on BBC One this coming Sunday at 9 p.m. Before our next interview, I'd like to quickly tell you about a couple of exciting digital products from BBC History magazine. The First World War Story is a new iPad app that describes the conflict through expert articles, stunning images, audio lectures and video. You can find out about the key battles and events of the war, as well as discovering how it impacted on the lives of ordinary soldiers and civilians. You can get hold of the First World War Story on iTunes now. It's priced at £4.99 in the UK or $6.99 in the US. Still on the iPad, our September edition of the magazine includes a special interactive feature on the Battle of Flodden. To coincide with the 500th anniversary of this crucial Anglo-Scottish clash, we've put together videos, audio and interactive maps to tell the story in a fresh and original way. Now, if you own an iPad and you're not already a digital subscriber, then this is a great time to start. You'll find us on the newsstand. Today also sees the release of our September edition in print. As well as our look at the Battle of Flodden, we're exploring the history of vampire attacks, meeting the French Revolution's Man of Terror, and revealing the perils of medieval letter writing. You can get hold of the September issue in the shops now. And now let's return to the world of historical fiction. Nick Renison, who writes our historical fiction reviews, has just completed a novel of his own, Carver's Quest. Our book's editor, Matt Elton, caught up with Nick to discuss his experiences of writing the book and to ask what advice he'd offer to other people hoping to get started in this industry.
It's my debut novel, which is called Carver's Quest, and it's set in the year 1870. It follows the adventures of a young gentleman named Adam Carver and his stroppy servant, Quint Devlin, and they're seeking out an ancient Greek manuscript which may or may not hold the key to the whereabouts of gold that once belonged to Philip II of Macedon, who was Alexander the Great's father. And in the process of looking for this manuscript, they stumble across dead bodies in London. They find themselves the targets of anti-English rioting in Athens. And they spend time in one of the strange, isolated monasteries of Meteora in Thessaly, which is where visitors are hauled up the side of mountains to the monasteries in nets and baskets. And everything comes to a climax in an archaeological dig a little bit further north in northern Greece, which was then under the control of the Ottoman Empire.
And how long has it taken you to write?
Well, it's taken me rather longer than I or my publisher was originally expecting, because originally I signed a contract that I would supply the novel in about just over a year, and in fact it turned out to be just short of 4 years that it took me to write it. And partly I think this was because I was a first-time novelist, and when I began writing I was kind of obsessed by research. I couldn't let a character walk across a room before I knew exactly what was in the room. I couldn't let a character say anything unless I knew that the words were the sort of words or were the exact words that someone in 1870 would be using. And eventually, after a period of time, I began to relax into the writing a bit and realized that although research is important, then the most important thing in a novel is the story, and that minute details of research are not as significant as the telling of the story, and that if you use a word in 1870 that the OED says doesn't come into use until 1875, that isn't an absolute disaster, and that the dialogue doesn't necessarily need to be absolutely 100% authentic. It just needs to sound plausible and convincing for that period. The kind of research that I was doing was originally reading a lot of history books on the Victorian period, and in the end I decided that the most important sort of research that I could do was reading writers from the period, because, you know, just as if you go to a foreign country today, then the best guide to that foreign country is somebody who's actually lived there, then the best guide to the Victorian era are those people who lived in it. So I did a lot of reading of 19th century novelists. I read a lot of Dickens, or reread a lot of Dickens, which, of course, although he died in 1870, which is the year that the novel's set, and I have the character at one point reading the news of his death in his paper, but I also read a lot of Trollope, who's very good on the detail of everyday life, and I read Wilkie Collins, who's good on the more sensational detail of the period, and I also read the Sherlock Holmes stories, which I mean, admittedly, they're from a little bit later in the century, but I'd previously written a book about Sherlock Holmes, so I wasn't going to allow that to, I needed to reread the Sherlock Holmes stories as well to include that as part of the research.
So did you go into writing the novel know that you wanted to write something set in that particular period?
Yes, I always wanted to write about the Victorian period because it was the period that I felt I knew most about, and also it was the period that I found most interesting as a period in which to set a crime novel. And because I'd lived in London and I'd read a lot about Victorian London, I wanted to set part of the novel in the city, but also I wanted to take the characters outside England, and one of the germs of the story actually came before any of that, which was about 6-7 years ago. I went to see these monasteries at Meteora. I don't know if you know them at all, but they're these extraordinary Greek Orthodox monasteries in Thessaly. They're on the UNESCO World Heritage Site. And lots of people have heard of the monasteries at Mount Athos. But in a way, these ones at Meteora are even more remarkable and memorable. They sit on the top of these pinnacles and cliff faces of rock which rise abruptly out of the plains of Thessaly. And even today, when we went in 2006, some of them are very difficult of access. And when I came back from Greece, I began to read about Meteora. And there are quite a few accounts by 19th century English travelers of visiting the monasteries and of the hair-raising methods that were used to get to them, that often the only way of getting to them was via long ladders which clung to the side of the cliffs, or possibly even worse, you had to climb into a net or a basket, and then you were hauled up this cliff face by the monks. And one of the people who visited was actually Edward Lear, the landscape painter and later the writer of Nonsense Verse. Although he very sensibly didn't trust himself to be hauled to the top, he stayed firmly on the ground and just sketched these monasteries. But if you look up Edward Lear and Meteora on the web, you can find some of his sketches of them. And after reading these accounts, I thought what a good idea it would be to have a character visit Meteora in that period. And I wrote a chapter in which characters arrive at the foot of one of the monasteries, and Adam Carver, the hero of the novel, is then hauled up the cliff face in a net. But unfortunately, I broke off in mid-chapter, and I went on to write lots and lots of other bits of the book. So poor old Carver was left hanging halfway up a cliff face, being shot at by brigands for about 6 months before I got back to look at him and rescue him from that situation.
That's interesting, actually. So you don't write the book straight through. You do bits here and there.
Well, I did in the end do that. I found myself writing. Originally, I devised a plan for the book and wrote that out in some detail, several thousand words as to what I wanted to do. But then I did find myself dodging about here and there from place to place in the storyline, writing a bit here and then going back and writing a bit there. I don't know whether that's what other novelists do. I reckon some of them probably do start at A and go straight through until they end at Z, but I didn't find it that way. I found that I had to write a little here and then move back and then move forward as the inspiration or as the idea struck me.
Sure. And you touched on there that the fact that you chose this period because you thought the type of book you were writing would fit it quite neatly. Why do you think that was the case?
Well, I mean, for one thing, I'm not alone in finding the Victorian period very fascinating. I mean, if you look at all sorts of the media at the moment, then the Victorian era is everywhere. On TV, we have, you know, Suspicions of Mr. Witcher and Ripper Street. And in the cinema, you've got somebody like Guy Ritchie is turns from writing about Cockney geezer, making films about Cockney geezer gangsters, and starts making films about Sherlock Holmes. If you look in the bestseller lists, both fiction and non-fiction for books, then there are an awful lot of titles that are set in the Victorian period. And I mean, I think the reason for that is that at first glance, the Victorians seem remarkably like us. It's the period is simultaneously both reassuringly familiar and very different as well. That if you look at them initially, they don't dress in togas and tunics like the ancient Romans. They don't, you know, wear suits of armor and ride into battle waving lances like 14th century knights. Give or take the odd peculiarity of dress and hairstyle and vocabulary, you think that the Victorians are very like us, and yet you delve a little deeper into the Victorian lives and they are actually just as strange and different from us as Roman legionaries or medieval warriors. You know, this is a world before cars, before planes, before cinema, before computers, before most of the media which have shaped modern minds. It's a world in which London is the largest city on earth and Britain's ruling over a fifth of the world's population. So they are very different from us, and yet they're recognisably us as well. So it's this, I think it's this combination of familiarity and strangeness that makes the Victorian era so appealing. And it's also very appealing for a certain style of crime fiction, because modern technology opens up all sorts of possibilities for writers, of course, but it closes down a lot of possibilities as well, because a lot of plot lines in crime fiction become impossible in a world in which we're forever connected on the internet and mobile phone. So that in Carver's quest, they're in quest of this manuscript that might be in a monastery library. I mean, today, they'd just go onto the monastery's website and check the manuscript in a matter of minutes. In 1870, they have to travel to Turkish-occupied northern Greece in order to see it. And there's another crucial episode in the book which depends on the hero not knowing the exact whereabouts of his companions. Now, that sort of plot line is not possible now, because if all of them had mobiles, any tension in the scene would be non-existent. They'd all be swapping texts and smiley faces every few minutes. So, as I say, I think by going back into the Victorian era, you can create a sort of old-fashioned crime novel in ways which you can't in a modern context.
That's really interesting. Do you think then that we're likely to see a kind of a growth in historical detective fiction simply because it solves some of those problems?
Well, I think perhaps we have already, actually. I mean, in the time that I've been involved in the book trade over the last 20 or 30 years, then I think there has been a huge increase in historical fiction. It's a much more widely published and widely read genre, and also there's been a big increase in historical crime fiction that from all periods, not just the Victorian period, but you know, medieval detectives and 18th century detectives, Roman detectives. I think there's been an increase in general in the genre. Mm.
So to what extent, when you're creating characters, do you try to make them in some way representative of the period in which the book's set?
I don't think you want them to be... You want them to fit into that period as well as you can. Obviously, you want them to be convincing as period characters. I don't think you necessarily want to make them representative in any way, perhaps representative of a particular type of character or type of individual from that society. I mean, when I was trying to come up with a character who would fit into the story and fit into the Victorian period, I mean, at first it was the kind of characters that I didn't want I didn't want a character who was a policeman, because there have been plenty of those. And anyway, at least in the 19th century, that kind of restricts what the character can do and the sort of areas in society where he can go. And I didn't want a private detective, because there have been even more of those. And whenever you create a private detective, even now, and certainly if you create a Victorian private detective, then the long shadow of Sherlock Holmes hangs over every single private detective from that period that's ever been created, I think. And I didn't want somebody who was too upper crust or too lower class, because that again restricts the area of society into which they can go. I wanted somebody who was to some extent a little bit of an outsider. So eventually I came up with Adam Carver, who in the novel was born into wealth, but he's lost his inheritance. His father was a railway baron who embezzled money. And then when his crimes were found out, then Carver Sr. committed suicide. So Carver Jr. at that time was at Cambridge. And after his father's suicide, the money's mostly gone. He's forced to leave college and make his own way in the world in circumstances he didn't expect to have to face. So he's a gentleman, but he's also a gentleman who has to live in and interact with ordinary society. And then, as Carver was the first character to come up, and then I came up with his surly and disgruntled servant, Quint, who was originally intended as a relatively minor character, but in the course of writing the book, he began to come more and more into prominence, and I found that he became quite a good foil to Carver, and also because he's from the lower classes, he's a foundling who's been left on, or was a foundling who was left on the steps of a church in the 1820s and has grown up on the back streets of London, then he became an ideal foil to Carver. And in the end, the publishers have billed the book as The First Adventure of Carver and Quint. And I think that's a kind of chalk and cheese partnership of two different characters, which is common enough in all kinds of crime fiction. But now Carver and Quint, I hope, work quite well within that tradition.
And what are the pleasures of writing fiction that you don't get from writing a factual historical book?
You can make it all up. When I was writing the spoof biography of Sherlock Holmes, which I published 6-7 years ago, then one of the delights of that was that if you couldn't find something in the Sherlock Holmes stories and you couldn't find it in the historical record, then you were able in the last resort just to make it up. And of course, writing a novel is all making it up in one sense. So it does give you a freedom that you don't have with non-fiction. You have to work within the parameters of historical fact and accuracy and how people might and might not have behaved in that time. But it does give you a freedom to let characters do a little bit more than they could do if they were real.
Of course,
characters,
yes.
Real people.
Okay. You obviously review fiction books for us each month in the magazine.
Yep.
Do you feel that added any pressure to you, the thought that they may be kind of considered in the same way?
Yeah. I think being a reviewer, because I not only review for you, but of course I write reviews for the Sunday Times as well, and I do regular historical fiction for them, and I also, in the rest of the reviewing that I do for them, I quite often review historical fiction. So being a reviewer and reading so many historical fictions, it's kind of both an advantage and a disadvantage. The disadvantage is sometimes feel you've read every kind of historical novel already, and then faced with coming up with your own, you think, my God, how am I going to come up with anything unusual or original or different? It's all been done before, and not only has it all been done before, I've read it all before. So that was a disadvantage, and it was again a bit of a constraint on me at first, until I felt a bit freer in the writing. The advantage is that because I've read such a lot of historical fiction over the years, you kind of become familiar with some of the, what's the word, phrase, tricks of the trade, I suppose, and that therefore, once I did get underway, I felt reasonably confident about the way in which it was going and how I was eventually going to bring it all together. And I certainly think that it then, having written one and a historical novel myself, I think it probably and hopefully in the future makes me a better and more sympathetic reviewer of historical novels, because you've got the insight of having written one of one's, you know, written your own novel, that you realise that it's a difficult job, and that you understand more about the process of writing that everybody you review has gone through.
I mean, that's an interesting point. What surprised you most, looking back from how you thought it would go writing the novel to the end of the process?
I think in the end it was the freedom that it gave you, that I was to begin with too constrained by the research and by my feelings that everything had to be so historically accurate, and everything had to be said. I forgot about the freedom that fiction does give you, and that if I went through a process of learning in the course of writing the novel, it was then to allow myself a bit more freedom than I gave myself at the beginning, and to just think, this is a story. In stories, all sorts of things can happen, and you don't have to find a reference to something on the pages of a work of history. You can allow yourself the freedom to use your imagination.
Are there any historical fiction writers that you particularly admire?
Well, there's lots of them, yes. I mean, at the moment, there are two particular writers that I think are absolutely wonderful. One's a British writer and one's an American writer. The British writer is Andrew Taylor, who some years ago published a novel called The American Boy, which is about Edgar Allan Poe. And I don't know if you know, but Edgar Allan Poe, when he was a young boy, spent time in Islington in North London. He went to school, for various reasons, his stepfather was in London and he went to school in Islington. So around that small fact, then Taylor builds this very clever and interesting mystery narrative. And he's also written one that was published this year called The Scent of Death, which is set in the 18th century in America, in fact at the time of the American Revolution, and it's about a British person who goes to New York, which is then held by loyalist troops, and New York's a loyalist region, but it's surrounded by troops of George Washington, and again a mystery takes place within that within the city, which is very good. The American writer that I really wish, I don't think he's particularly well known over here, and I wish he was better known. His name's Lewis Bayard, B-A-Y-A-R-D, and he's written several historical mystery novels, one of which is called Mr. Timothy, which is about takes the character of Tiny Tim from Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, and it's about Tiny Tim when he's grown up and is a young man, and he's involved in a mystery story in Victorian London. And Bayard's also written a book called The Black Tower, which is about the French criminologist Eugène Vidocq, beginning of the 19th century, 1810s, 1820s. And it's about the mystery about whether or not Louis XVII, the Dauphin, the young child who was supposedly killed in the Bastille during the French Revolution, and some people think that possibly he survived, and Vidocq in Bayard's novel investigates the mystery of whether or not this child did survive. He's very, very good. I really admire him. But he's not particularly well known in this country, I don't think. But there are, you know, lots and lots of... There's another one who wrote a novel which I reviewed earlier this year called William Palmer. He wrote a novel called The Devil is White, which is about a group of people in late 18th century, early 19th century England who, anti-slavery people who try and create a utopian community on an island just off the coast of Africa, and everything goes disastrously and appallingly wrong. And that all, again, is a very, very good novel, I think.
What advice would you give to other first-time historical novelists or people looking to set out writing that kind of book?
My advice would be to keep on going, because there were times when, as I think the fact that it took me nearly four years to do, you can imagine there were times when I thought, I'm never going to do this, I'm never going to finish it, I'm never going to get beyond the 20,000 words that I've done or whatever. But if you do keep on going, then I think eventually you will, you know, it's possible to bring things together and to finish the book. And it took me a long time to, as a first novelist, to feel relaxed about writing fiction, to get the idea of where the book was going and how it was all going to be brought together. It took time, but it did eventually work, or I think it worked anyway. And I say people should be encouraged to be persistent and keep on going, I think.
And are there any other historical periods that you'd like to set a novel?
The one thing that I would like to write a novel about sometime in the future, I don't know whether I will ever get the chance or not to do so. I may be stuck in the Victorian period for the foreseeable future, I don't know. But the one period I would like to... I have an interest in old movies, and not just the golden age of Hollywood in the 30s and 40s, but also British movies and the British movie industry in the 1930s. And I would quite like to set a novel in one of the small British film studios. There were a lot of film studios in 1930s London, places like Twickenham and Ealing, of course. And I think it would be quite an interesting... you could have a good murder mystery, because it would be an enclosed community, which is very often a good way, a good place in which to set a murder mystery, because, you know, there are plenty of suspects, but there's a restricted number of suspects because it's the people within the enclosed community. And I just would quite like to write about the film industry, and the British film industry in particular.
That was Nick Renison. Nick's new book, Carver's Quest, is out now, published by Corvus. And that's almost all for this week. Do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we will do our best to read out some of your messages in future episodes. One person who got in contact was Fiona Bamforth from Canada. She writes, "In April, I listened to your review of the Pompeii and Herculaneum exhibition at the British Museum. I was immediately captivated and finally got to see it last week. With the airfare from Western Canada and three nights in a London hotel, it was probably the most expensive exhibition I have ever visited, but worth every cent. Had it not been for History Extra, I would never have heard of it." Well, thanks for that, Fiona, and we're very glad to have been of service. And when it comes to getting in touch with us, you can also contact us on social media. On Twitter, we're @HistoryExtra. Plus, you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/HistoryExtra. Next week, we'll be talking about Henry VIII's clash with the Scots at Flodden. Do join us for that. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.